Jean-Michel, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And okay, Jean-Michel, you are the founder of Grail Capital. You're an executive at Ledger. You did many, many different functions at Ledger, but we can dive into that more. And you're broadly an investor, an operator, and really an expert at the bleeding edge of the digital art revolution. So, Jean-Michel, tell me all about your background. Like, how did you get involved in crypto, NFTs, and the whole thing?
Okay. Hello, Andrew. Hello, everyone. I'm very happy to be with you today. My story, I'm French. I'm based in Paris right now and at the NFT factory. But my life, I've been lucky enough to have different lives, I would say. And everything is now connecting itself to what I'm doing today. So what I first did is for almost a decade, I worked in traditional finance, New York, London, and Paris, mostly for a company called New York Stock Exchange. NYSE and Euronext, which is the European equivalent. And I did finance and strategy and IPO. And I decided to move into the fintech space in 14. And within the fintech space, I decided to go for this little tiny niche that was called blockchain Bitcoin. And within that very small ecosystem, it was, in 14, 15, it was only probably I say maybe 10 billion market cap, so very, very tiny. And I decided to join this company that was amazing to me, that was French. So I was lucky enough to be French and they were French. And this company was Ledger. And basically I started to help them on a couple of things because they were very small and advising them on a couple of things. And then one thing leading to another, I basically was the first executive that they hired that was not part of the founding team. So we are late 16, I would say. And then the rest is history because then, 17 started to arrive and the market started to expand a little bit. And obviously Ledger was extremely well positioned in this security, ecosystem with the hardware wallet. And the company grew quite a bit, between say 17 and 23. And so for 6 years, amazing year at Ledger. And I decided to leave, in January this year, not because I didn't like what I was doing at Ledger, because Ledger is an amazing company and still is, but because I basically found what I wanted to do after that. And what I wanted to do is to help the digital art on blockchains, becoming, an industry as well, of much bigger importance, both from a cultural and from an economic slash financial standpoint. So just when I entered the crypto space, when the market cap was around 10 billion, the funny thing is that right now the digital art market is around the 7 billion market cap again. So, and right now, as you know, crypto market is a 1.4, 1.5 trillion. And my kind of bold, statement and my goal somehow is that this digital art market on blockchains will become a 1 trillion market cap in the next 10 to 15 years. And that's my goal. Obviously, I will not be the only one to participate to that, but I want to contribute. And the best way to contribute is with Grail Capital. And Grail Capital is actually an advisory and investment firm that is basically, investing in the future of art. And we are only acquiring and collecting, digital artworks on blockchain, so NFTs. We are not doing, physical artwork that are tokenized or whatever. We are purely collecting and acquiring, natively digital artworks, I would say. And I did that with my co-founder, actually, with Tim Salikov. He's a former Morgan Stanley investment banker and Lazard private equity investor. He's based out of New York. I'm mostly based in Europe, and we are covering both continents from where we are. And the reason why, beyond being at Ledger and having the chance to, discover the NFT and specifically, the ERC 721 and the first CryptoPunks back in the days, from a technological angle first, I've always been a collector. I've always collected, collectibles, but mostly street art and then photography. And because I was kind of not so sure of what I was buying, in especially, sorry, photography, that it's very easy to falsify, I would say, to counterfeit. I started to buy, quite expensive photography, and at some point I was not so sure that there were just 10 of them. So say you buy a for photography and there's 10 out of 10 and you buy for 5K, well, if there's 10, that's okay. And if the, obviously, if the artwork and the artist is good and famous. But all of a sudden, if it's not 10, but if it's 100 or 1,000, obviously the rarity is not the same and therefore the price cannot be the same. And I was not always sure of what I was buying. And therefore, when the NFT came out, I said, wow, it's solving all my problems as a collector, the scarcity, the provenance, even the fact that, you know, you know exactly what you are buying, you know, who owned it before you. You know that there will never be more than 10, if there is 10. And if the artist make the mistake of issuing another 10, that's his problem. And then his quote will be totally fucked up. So obviously he will never make it. So that's why I really saw that this digital artwork, is what I want to spend my next 10 to 15 years. And that's why I decided to launch Whale Capital.
Okay. Amazing. I'm super pumped to kind of dig deeper everywhere, but all right, take me all the way back. You said that in, I think it was like 2014, which is incredible. You were at New York Stock Exchange, and there was an area there that was called FinTech, and that was like a subsector of like blockchain. All right, so tell me, like, why, how did you even discover that, and like, why did you want to focus your attention on that small subsector?
It's about, I've got one quality, which is curiosity. I'm relatively curious in life, and because a long time ago I was head of research for NYSC, so basically I was the guy who was in charge of finding the new sector, you know, the kind of sector that will generate, you know, new listings and trading for New York Stock Exchange. So obviously, you know, I worked on biotech, I worked on clean tech, I worked on a lot of tech stuff, and basically I was kind of always looking for this kind of new things. And basically in 13, I started to, you know, I heard about Bitcoins, but it was like a bit blurry. It was somewhere in my mind, but I must say that I didn't take the time in 13 to really deep dive into that. And in 13, what happened is that, there is this, European, debt crisis, you know, with a lot of, you know, Greece and Spain was some problem. And there is Cyprus. And Cyprus has a big bank run. I think we are in Feb or March 13, if not mistaken. And there is a bank run. And again, I basically got a call from New York and the guy said, okay, Jean-Michel, you need, because I was on holiday, and say, you need to come back because we have a problem and you need to work on certain things, I would say. And I come back, and while I was coming back, I was reading a lot of things about, you know, what is happening in Cyprus and the banks that's just closed. And all of a sudden, all the money that people had on their bank account, they could not get access of it. And then I heard that some of them are actually using this stuff, Bitcoin, again, to actually, you know, get their money out. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And so I promised to myself that as soon as I would have finished this project, I will take more time digging into the NFT, in the Bitcoin. And it took me a while because it was relatively young, relatively small. There was a lot of things online, but it was very difficult to have a proper conversation with someone online about it, or about on very, you know, very, you know, obscure forums, I would say, by then. And so I started discussing with a couple of people, but it was not at the level of my expectations. And fast forward, and again, it's about curiosity and luck, because both of them are working together sometimes. In May 2014, I was in Paris, and there is this location that was just created that was called the House of Bitcoin, La Maison du Bitcoin in French, that was created by two entrepreneurs. So I came there, I asked a lot of questions. The guys are very smart. One is a former entrepreneur and ex-poker professional player, and the other is a former BCG analyst, you know, and very smart guys. And I start to have a proper conversation, and actually those two guys were the co-founders of Ledger. So fast forward a few months after, they create Ledger, and basically we kept in touch. And again, that's what led one thing leading to the other. And that's honestly, that's a bit of curiosity. That's a lot of luck, but that's also meeting the right person at the right moment. And having this kind of, again, I've seen things before, like things that were very small that became very big, and seeing that, you know, just from a probability perspective, there is a risk that it goes to zero by then, you know, but let's say that the percentage of chance is 80% that Bitcoin and all the stuff goes to zero. But the 20% remaining, you know, it can be like 5%, it do 2x, 5% it do 5x, 5% it do et cetera, et cetera. And this kind of mathematic approach to probability led me to think that it was worth my spending some time on that. And that's basically why I decided to spend a few years on that. And I was lucky enough, again, to be right, not exactly at the right time, but after a couple of years, I was right. So I was quite happy.
That's awesome. Okay, so you mentioned that you have always been a collector. And so even when you're, you know, pre-ledger, you were collecting stuff and photography and art and whatnot. Where did that love of collecting come from? Like when you were little, were you collecting, or was this kind of a more adult activity?
Obviously, like all the kids, because I'm French, so probably that, you know, the equivalent of you guys in the US would be that you probably have all collected, you know, some baseball cards, football cards, or NBA cards. So I was doing the same when I was young, you know, with the soccer kind of Panini card. That is the old version of the So Rare cards, for those of you who know. So I was collecting that, obviously, because I was a football fan myself. But the real collecting habit started when I started to work and to make my own money. And then I started to collect street art. And the reason why I was collecting street art is because it was very democratic, because street art was in the street. So basically, you don't need to go to a museum or to a gallery. You can be whoever you are. There is no, everybody can have access to that. So I found it very interesting. It was very easy. You just had to go and to see. And all of a sudden, you can see a Banksy, you can see a Space Invader, you can see Obey Giant and stuff like that. And again, because of my job, and I was lucky enough to be between New York, London, and Paris, those were the three locations where basically the three artists that I just mentioned, so Banksy in London, Space Invader in Paris, and Shepard Fairey in New York, even though he was from the West Coast, I was basically getting exposure to those artists in the street. And so I basically started to collect some of their artworks, which was very, very cheap by the time, even though Banksy already started to be a bit expensive. Voilà. So I started collecting street art, and street art led me to photography because obviously most of the artworks that are street art, they are in the street. So either they do what we call alias, so digital physical twin of what is in the street, and they redo it for collectors, or they take picture. So basically, I started to buy photographies, and then photographies led me to contemporary photography, and photography led me to NFTs. Because being a collector, you know, is very interesting, because I must say that I am a real collector in the sense that, you know, I have a vision of what my collection should look like, and I'm not happy until I've reached that goal. And obviously, the older you are and the more sophisticated your brain is somehow, and the more complex the collection and the bigger the collection. And therefore, that means that it's probably a never ending story. You know, it's never ending. But that's a great journey because of art and because of my collecting habits, I probably visited the most amazing places, I met the most amazing person, whether they're artists, curators. And it's extremely, you know, great in terms of inclusivity, because there is no race, no gender, no sex, no age, nothing. Just what matters is the cultural significance of the art. And again, that has been extremely, for me, I think art made me a better person, basically. Collecting art.
That's awesome. Wow. Okay. All right. So now, you know, Grail Capital, you started with your good friend, Tim. And what was tell me about the genesis of that. You know, were you buddies with Tim and you're like, hey, Tim, like, this is going to be exciting. We got to make a move here. Like, tell me how Grail Capital started.
I don't know if I've ever seen that. So basically, Tim and I, we knew each other. And the reason why we knew each other is because we are both on Twitter. As you know, the crypto Twitter, but also the NFT Twitter is very important. And basically, the way we really connected together. So Tim is extremely analytical. He's a very smart analyst. Mindset, former research person again at Morgan Stanley. So he's very good at taking something complex and kind of split the problem, and that makes, you know, easy to understand, I would say. So I was kind of amazed by the kind of input he was making as tweets about digital art and NFTs, generally speaking. And we started to share by like that. And actually, the very funny thing is that he reached out to me once. And because he's a good analyst, he looked in one of my wallets, and he basically made a very, very deep analysis of my wallet. And I said to myself, wow, the guy, he can understand not only what I've been collecting, obviously what is worth or what is less worth, but also he kind of understood what I'm trying to build. And you know, that's very secret sauce. You know, when you are a collector, you build your collection, you don't say, hey, I collect this and that for that reason. You know, you just do your stuff, and because otherwise you'll get front run, so which you don't want to be. And basically he gave this kind of insight. So I said to myself, wow, this guy is not only smart, but he has this investment, you know, mindset. And I was already thinking of building this investment firm. And I knew also, because I've been an entrepreneur before and I've helped entrepreneurs doing and building great projects and great ventures, I knew that I didn't want to be alone, just because, you know, there's a French saying that alone you go fast, but together you go farther. And therefore, I think that I was basically looking for some kind of partners. And, you know, it's just that, again, it's just a kind of luck or whatever you call fortune. And we decided to, so we discussed about that. I told him, hey, you know, I'm planning to leave Ledger and I'm planning to launch something that would look like an investment fund for digital art with NFTs. Would you like to look into that? And he very quickly said yes. And again, one thing leading to the other, that's when we decided to launch Grail.
Very cool. Okay, so tell me about the thesis, because, you know, NFTs are such a broad market. You have video game items, you have virtual land, you have, you know, all sorts of, NFTs can basically be anything. So why were you attracted to the digital art specifically? And, you know, tell me, expand on your thesis up to like the $1 trillion kind of opportunity here.
So actually, again, because I'm the former head of research, I always start at a macro level and then I get down to the micro level. I looked at a couple of things. I look at the art market right now. I looked at the alternative assets market right now. And I looked at the crypto assets market. So those three kind of markets. The global art market that is owned by high net worth individual. I'm not talking about what is owned by institutions, museums, or whatever. Only high net worth individual, it's a 2.2 trillion market right now, 2.2 trillion USD. Okay. So, voilà. So that's already that size. Then you have a second market, which is the crypto market, which is 1.4, 1.5, or even let's say a year ago, it was 1 trillion, but that's 1 trillion still. And then you've got the alternative assets market, which is a 25 trillion. So you have those three markets. And I tend to believe that digital art market on blockchain is intertwined between those three. It takes a little, right now, it takes a little market share of each of those three. But I believe that eventually it will, you know, scrunch a little bit of each. And just if those three markets stay at the same level as they are today, I think that just by a market share aggregation, it will get to 1 trillion in the next 10 to 15 years, just because it is what it is today. And it will, again, scratch a little bit from the art market. So say that the 2.2 trillion, you just get 5%. 5%, it's 100 billion, 100 billion. Then if you say it takes just 1% of the, you know, of the alternative assets, it's 25, so it's 250 billion. So you already have 350 billion just for that. And then obviously, if you add to that the crypto, which is a 1.5 right now, but say that it's, you know, 3-5 trillion, you know, 5-10 years from now, again, you add another 500 or whatever. And then you basically arrive to around 1 trillion. So that's how we basically came with this 1 trillion USD market opportunity. Obviously, we won't go there, you know, like that. It will take 10, maybe 15 years. But I am extremely convinced that we'll reach that 1 trillion. And I think sometimes it might be appear as being mad. But because Bitcoin did it, because art did it, and because alternative assets did it in just 25 years, yeah, I think it's quite possible, or at least it's not impossible that he will reach this 1 trillion threshold in the next, again, 10 to 15 years, maybe a little bit after, but you know, I'm relatively confident in that. So that's the macro level, and that's a too big opportunity to be missed. And now why we are doing it, because for me to succeed, you need to have a couple of things. You need to have a good understanding of the art world. One, you have to understand the digital art world. Second, you need to understand crypto, because right now crypto is a key component of the digital art world on blockchains. And you need to have this investment / alternative investment market understanding and professionalism, And we bring all of that basically with Tim because of what he did at Morgan Stanley, at Lazard, what I did at NYC, what I did at Ledger, et cetera, et cetera. We bring all those things in just two people. So that's why I said, yes, you know, just from an outsider perspective, we are checking the boxes. And we see that, you know, when we go in front of institutional investors or high net worth individual, usually we don't have to explain for too long what we are doing. Because our kind of pedigree, what we did before is kind of, is enough for them to believe in us. At the end of the day, obviously the investors, they have to believe in our statement about this market size and, you know, that we are 7 billion market cap right now and it will go to 1 trillion in 10 to 15 years. So that's quite a stretch. But if they believe that it will still be there in 10 years, we are not the only one, but we are one of the teams in the market that probably check the box to get to that institutionalization of digital art as an asset class.
That's awesome. Okay, wow. Is there something to like? So what is the thought process around, you know, I guess these high net worth investors, these high net worth collectors, which, by the way, no idea the market was that big just on that alone, not even museums. Like, why would they prefer digital art? Because, you know, don't you think it's going to be mostly young people like us, you know, not these 80-year-old guys and girls?
Oh my God, that's such a good question. I will try not to be too blunt on that, but you nailed it, basically. I think it's a very generational thing. I must say that I'm spending, let's say, 20% of my time talking to traditional art collectors. Yes, I mean, I've discussed with amazing, and I know amazing collectors of traditional art that are in their 50s and even in the 60s, and some of them are all of them are super smart, by the way, but some of them are, you know, open-minded enough to say that, okay, this thing can be one thing. It can be worth something. And some of them believe, that's true, but it's not the majority. To be quite direct, yes, a majority of the people who believe are between, say, 25 till 45. And I would put the limit around 45, 50. That start to be a bit a stretch for the majority of the art collectors. But that's fine, you know, and that's totally understandable because the people who have been extremely successful in traditional art collecting, for instance, because they understood the market, they understand the market dynamics, and I think that it takes years to get there. And with digital art on blockchain, it's a new market. Technically speaking, it was not even a market 3 years ago, you know, it's just a market for 3 years. Things were pre-existing before. Rare Pepe, Beeple was there, Xcopy was there. The crypto coins were there, obviously, but from a market perspective, it's only a 3 years market. So it's very young. And that means that, obviously, why would those people take so much risk, you know, spending time to try to understand because it's brand new? So that's why I think that the players, the key players, and by the way, that's very traditional in everything. You know, there's a book called Innovator Dilemma by Clayton Christensen that has been my kind of table book for many years. And basically, this book stays always the same. As soon as there is a new technology or a new market, the incumbent never get it. It's always the newcomers because they understand, because they are quick, because it's okay for them to do tiny revenue to start with because they are small, so they're just hungry. Whereas the big stuff, they don't really care. And that's exactly that was the case for Bitcoin in 14. That's the case for digital art in 2023. That's always, you know, history keep on repeating itself. So long, very long answer, but yes, the majority of the collector I'm talking to are more what we call the next gen. So the next generation. So more the daughter or the son or the granddaughter or the grandson of the big traditional art collector.
What has been some of the biggest pushback you have heard or experienced about digital art from these like traditional collectors? Are they like, oh, because, you know, one thing I heard over and over again was you can't touch the art. You know, like you can't touch it. And I'm like, are you touching your paintings? Like, I don't touch that ever. You know what I mean? And by the way, for those listening on the podcast, I'm pointing to that. There's a piece of art behind me you can see on YouTube. But yeah, so like, I thought that was always a funny thing to say. And art, so much of the value is like narrative driven, anyways. So like, why does it even matter what medium you're experiencing the art through? That's my personal opinion. What are some things that you've experienced in terms of that pushback, and what has been your rebuttal?
This one is probably the one that I hear the most. You know, this, oh, it doesn't exist, it's not physical, I can't touch it.
I said
exactly the same thing as you just said. And the good thing is that I've been a street art collector before and a photography collector. And I'm always using this analogy with photography. I said, do you know that 98% of photography taken in the world right now are digital? Because we are only taking, almost nobody is taking photography anymore on physical, you know, on physical, you know, negative. Everything is digital. So the native creation of photography is digital. And then you decide that you mint it, and then eventually that you print it on Dibon or on paper or whatever. But, you know, for me, the display and the way you present your art matters less than the real matrix and the real negative. So that's why I always use this analogy of a digital negative for photography. And then if I'm able to lead them into that direction within the photography world, then I can drive them to the rest, you know, of the thing. That's also why we are digital native only. So for instance, for me, you know, I prefer ideally someone that is working natively with a digital, whether it's a paintbrush, whether it's a digital photograph, whether it's a, you know, a digital palette or software or everything. Whereas someone that would paint something and would take a picture or scan it and all of a sudden becomes an NFT. I'm not saying that it has less value. I just said that for me, it's more difficult to understand that. And I prefer to work on the digital native artworks rather than on a digital twin of a physical artworks. So that's where for me the power lies. And also because, and that's something that most of the people understand very well, especially the big collectors. When you collect, and I was collecting quite heavily street art and photography before, the fact that you have a digital artworks that can be created and transferred and stored in a digital form, it's so convenient. It's so fast, and the market is worldwide. Because say that you want to buy a Warhol, you are in the US, and there is a magnificent Warhol just in front of me at Pompidou, let's say, and you want to acquire that from them. It will take you a minimum of 6 months to make it. Between the time that you discuss, the time that you agree, the time that there is the insurance valuation, and then the everything, and the payment, and it will take you 6 months. Whereas if you agree, if you and I, we agree on the CryptoPunks, in 10 minutes, it's done. So for me, you know, velocity is a key component, obviously, because I've been working in traditional financial market before. Velocity and the ability of an asset to trade and to be exchanged in a very quick way is a factor of growth of this market. And that has been theorized during the whole world. Every time there is a new asset, the fact that it can be traded very quickly makes it valuable because people can, you know, just trade and speculate, but others are holders, others need to hedge themselves. And that is the story of traditional financial markets. So that's why I also believe that this asset, which is cultural at first, has this financial component that makes it very, very interesting in terms of tradability and therefore in terms of valuation.
Super interesting. Okay, so I guess, you know, it's more liquid, it's more tradable, it's more secure. You don't need insurance, or maybe you do need insurance like in the future, but like for now, there's no physical product that can be damaged. So like, can you see a future where the digital art market surpasses in market, in like total market cap, we'll call it? Will it ever surpass the traditional art market? Or you're like, no, they're going to continue to both grow and be their separate things?
Well, my deep thought about that is that in 20 years, it will surpass the
traditional. In 20 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
And this, again, it's just, I think it's very bold. So it's bolder on bolder. But I think that, again, I've been studying, you know, a lot of market that were, a lot of industries, you know, whether it's hospitality with Airbnb, whether it's mobility with Uber, whether it's everything, you know, every industry that are extremely, brick and mortar. At first, you have a tiny players with a new technology or new software or new platform, whatever that comes, eventually solve a few number of people problems. And it's a niche. And then it expands because this niche starts to grow and because it solves problems of more and more people. And then eventually, all of a sudden you have this, you know, yellow cab, you know, in the New York market that I think in terms of revenue in 2007, it was, I don't know, like 5 or 7 billion per year, I think, in terms of revenue per year. And right now, I think that the revenue that Uber is doing in New York is probably a multiple of that. So if you looked in 07, 08 at this market and you say, well, you know, the market of mobility in New York will never exceed 10 billion. But guess what? Today it's probably 30, 40, I don't know, billion. So I tend to believe that this could happen to art and culture. So that's why I'm adding culture to art. And I tend to believe that, again, just for generational standpoint, from generational perspective, sorry, I think that in 20 years, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if the new generation, they rely more on digital artifacts than on physical artifacts from a cultural standpoint. So look, say what Bored Ape has been doing. In just 2 years, 3 years, they build a brand that is as powerful as Supreme or whatever that took them a decade to build. And that's just one example. But I really believe that from an art and cultural perspective, in the next 20, 25 years, yeah, the digital art market could surpass the traditional art market in terms of valuation. But again, I'm probably too bold for today and just start to get to the 100 billion and then to the 1 trillion and then we'll see for the rest.
Okay, remember it. 20 years from today, you're going to be back on the pod, and we're going to assess it if you're correct for sure.
I wish we do.
I have faith. I have faith that you will be very correct. But all right, so how do you define digital art? Because you know, there's like within the NFT world, there are different assets, and the definitions can be a bit nebulous. Like, what's a collectible? What's a baseball card versus what's a piece of art? How do you define it?
Well, that's where the gray zone comes in. So technically speaking, you know, and then that's up for experts to discuss. For instance, I probably, and by the way, disclaimer, I own Bored Ape as a person, as a collector. I own CryptoPunk as a professional investor with Gray. For me, and again, I like books, but for me, CryptoPunk is a piece of culture and a piece of art, and Bored Ape is a piece of culture, but not a piece of art. And the reason why is because the way the creators of CryptoPunks was to have this cultural moment, even though most of the time when you create something like that, probably that what it is today is not exactly what they thought in the first place, because that's how all the greatest things have been built. You know, you want to do something and eventually your creation gets out of from you and the market does something from it that is not what you expect. But when you look at it from a cultural standpoint, it is resonating with some stuff that happened in the past. For instance, I remember that the very first time I saw CryptoPunk, it reminded me of the pixel art movement, which was very small, and Space Invader, for instance, which is with a French street artist that is relatively famous and successful. He was doing dies, and when you see the first time I saw CryptoPunks, I said, "Oh, it looks like Space Invader." So there is a correspondence between the CryptoPunk from a visual perspective, from an aesthetic perspective, and what has been done in the past. And art is always about the link between the past, the present, and the future. The history of art is this kind of very, very complex thing. And, you know, there is one artist that, you know, like Van Gogh, and Van Gogh was there because there was Gauguin or whoever before, and there is Picasso, and Picasso was there because, and so, the art market is always looking for correspondence between two missing links, I would say. And I tend to believe that it's the way to look at art, generally speaking, and specifically digital art. And there is the aesthetic component again, that obviously is very, special to everyone. And probably that some people will disagree with me and say, oh, but no, CryptoPunks are not art, or Bored Ape are art, etc. So that's fine, but I think that at the end of the day, there will be a consensus, just like there is a consensus with the blockchain when you mine something. And I think that, yeah, we will go in the direction where Bored Ape are culture and CryptoPunks are culture and art. And that's just an example.
Super interesting, yeah. And, you know, part of my way of defining it, because for me myself, I'm like, how do I, you know, define what's what? I go to, like, utility. So, you know, I think Bored Apes have more utility than a CryptoPunk. Therefore, you know, they're less art than a CryptoPunk, but even that, it's like, you know, who's, you know, that in of itself is kind of nebulous as well. So I think utility can also play kind of a indicator, you know, role.
I totally agree. That would have been my second, matrix decision way of thinking, that utility, if utility is the main driver of the value, then that's another kind of NFT than art NFT, I would say. Because normally with art, the only utility is the aesthetic approach and the cultural approach and the fact that you value this, not the utility, like, say you get access to certain things, certain events, certain drops, certain merchandising, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, I agree with your approach of the utility.
What about like a baseball card, or, like a digital baseball card, let's say, because, there's no like baseball card game. You just kind of collect it purely. So, it doesn't really have any utility, but it's, calling it a piece of art is almost like, is it though? So what is your opinion on let's say a baseball card?
That's why we're mentioning art on one side, that is pure art and culture. And that's why we try to get this blurry line between the two, because I think that culture is bigger than art. So art is part of culture. So culture is the largest market, and art is a key component of the culture world. And I'm trying to be inclusive and not exclusive. And that's why we say that Grail Capital is about investing in the future of digital art and culture, because we believe that eventually, right now art is relatively easy to understand, and you can say CryptoPunks are worth 55 ETH, right now for a floor price or whatever it is. And I can explain you why. Obviously, I cannot go with a DCF, a discounting cash flow, whereas there are some people in the market that can explain you why a Bored Ape can be worth 30 or 35, ETH, the floor price right now. And they can come with a very complex discounted cash flow, saying, okay, if they do this and that and that. But they value the company more. They value token more as a company, some kind of, it's a utility token, but, And I tend to believe that that's just art on one side. You cannot get that. You just value the cultural aspect and the aesthetic again. Whereas for culture, you probably have to value somehow the utility. Or and when you for your baseball card, for instance, if it's just a beautiful piece of art and there is scarcity, that's art and culture. But then if you can use them and you can play with them and you can win some stuff because you are picking the right, the right baseball card player for the next weekend match and whatever, and he scores or he do a home run or whatever, then you probably will win a little bit. So that's the kind of stuff. But again, I'm trying to be as global as possible and as agnostic as possible so that we avoid falling in putting things into boxes. We put things into boxes, but we try to look at all the boxes together, I would say.
Very cool. All right, so this is a big question. I think people have been asking this for hundreds of years, probably, maybe thousands. How do you assess a piece of art in terms of like its value? When you're looking at a digital piece of art, an NFT, how are you saying, all right, this is worth X?
Probably that will have to take 1 hour to get to that, and bare minimum, and I will probably just scratch the surface. So it's a very complex process, and again we try to come with some simple rule of thumb so that at least we can explain that to our investors and potential investors and limited partners. So we look at art, and not culture right now, Dutch digital artworks, from a couple of angles. We look at them first in terms of what they are today, but more importantly, what they will be tomorrow. So say, and one of the key things that we are doing is that we are drawing parallel between nowadays famous artists and nowadays famous, not very famous, but famous in the crypto space, digital artists. So say we have Warhol on one side and Banksy and Basquiat, who are famous. All their artworks are worth between 10, 30, 50 million dollars each. And their prints are valued between, say, 50, 100K, whatever. And now we say, okay, who will be the Banksy, the Warhol, the Kesaring, and the whoever, in 2030? And basically, we believe that their price will be worth like Warhol. So we look at the market and we say, okay, this artist might be the new Warhol. This artist might be the new Basquiat, et cetera, et cetera. And so you start with that. Obviously, that what we call the terminal value of the one-on-one in, again, 7, 10 years from now. But then you have more granularity because each one of one is not equal to the other, and there are some great Xcopy, there are some other Xcopy that are probably less nice or whatever from an aesthetic standpoint. And so you start to have internally within an artistic universe of a creator, you need to choose which one is the best or which one will be the best and the most iconic. So we are very looking for what we call cultural significance and things that will become iconic, both from the artists and from the artworks. And then you also have the one-on-one, but you have the one of X or the editions. And that brings another layer of analysis because all of a sudden you need to, within the same artistic universe, you need to then decide, okay, which collection should I buy, this one or that one? And then you get to the point. So I'm just scratching the surface there. Obviously, there's a lot of components, but those are the real big high-level way of looking at it. And obviously, there is the market, because the market, again, I've been there for 3 years now. And I would say that, you know, the market in certain collections, I'm not talking about the one-on-one, because the one-on-one, like the Xcopy or the people, they are very expensive already, and the market is not so dynamic because not everybody can buy a Beeple or Xcopy or one-on-one. But for the collections, which is the one that we are focused the most right now because it's the most liquid segment of the digital art market, say Squiggle, Chromie Squiggle. Those are assets hyper liquid. And what we call the bid-ask spread, which is the difference between the best bid and the best ask, is actually very tiny. Even during the bear market, I think it never went above 7%. So that means that if, say, you buy one and you have to sell it immediately, you just lose 7%, which is good. That's, you know, for such a young asset, it doesn't happen much. You know, if you buy some like super exotic tech stock right now, you know, say, I don't know, in Sweden or even, I don't know when, you buy it and you have to sell it immediately. I'm not sure you will sell it at a 7% loss. You might get 20%, 30%, just because there's a bid spread is high. So for me, that also shows that this start to become a market. If I'm looking at things again from a ex financial market professional. And again, that's why also we are focusing more on the collections. And then you just start to say, okay, you know, how many are they and what are the price? What is the last price and what people are ready to pay for that specific rarity, et cetera, et cetera. And then you, and sorry, because I would have to stop there, but I think that there is a lot of complexity, and that's actually why we believe that, you know, it's great to collect digital art. It's great and everybody should do, but that's also why we believe at Grail Capital that, you know, if you want to do serious investment, either you spend a lot of time or either you rely on people like us. And by the way, we are not the only one, but and I'm just looking for professional investors right now because unfortunately we are not open to the public. We are just, you know, targeting super high net worths and qualified investors, so professional investors. But again, I think that it's a job, you know, it's a job. Just like, you know, you can be the best guy, you know, playing tennis over the weekend, 1 or 2 hours. But if you really want to be able to eventually beat a top ATP player, you need to play all the weeks, 8 hours a day. That's the only way. And you need to do that for 4 years.
Okay, so my thought process on valuing digital art, and I guess supposedly physical art, but I don't really focus on physical art ever, but has been the values derived from the artist's reputation and brand. So that's me personally. But in your opinion, like, how important is the artist in determining the value of a piece? And is it like, you know, the story that's driving the value? Or is it just, you know, I don't know, let's say like Vitalik Buterin, you know, made this NFT and, you know, it was 10 years ago. So it's really early, one of the first NFTs. I guess, tell me about the artist and, you know, the value, and tell me about the story and the value.
Oh my God. You know, Andrew, we are so complimentary. We should ask you to come with us at Grail Capital and be the first.
There we go.
Because basically you just mentioned the very important piece, which is, you know, the artist, I would say, footprint or visibility. And yes, I would say everything that relates to this, status symbol, that an artist brings. Because a lot of the storytelling that you mentioned. You know, I'm a good friend with Drift, Isaac Wright, who is one of the most famous, you know, photographer. He's, for those of you who don't know, he's basically climbing like at crazy heights, in big skyscrapers, and at the very, very last, he's taking pictures of his feet. That happens to be before with Vans, and now I think it's with Nike, if not mistaken. And basically, you know, when I collected his artwork 2 years ago, I remember that I've got a good friend who is a big collector of photography, and when I showed him, he said, "I've seen that already." I said, "Yes, but Isaac has its own story. And what makes value is not only his art, it's what is behind his art." And by the way, we saw that because since then, a lot of people, if not a lot, but some photographers took, you know, the same risk and going high and taking pictures of whatever. But they will never reach this status that he got, that it's about the story and so many things. You know, when you look at art, say the most famous painting in the world is Mona Lisa by, you know, Leonardo da Vinci. If there is no story, like we don't know who she is, you know, the fact that he brought it from Italy to Paris, etc., there is a lot of story behind the story and behind the artwork itself. So we are social animals. Humans are social animals, and what makes us live and what makes us dream is story. So I think you're totally right. The stories behind the artwork is a key component of the value creation. And because we are in a what we call a cult somehow, the cult grows, and it grows because there is good story. If there is no good story and it's just visually appealing, or there's just one expert in the market that says, "Oh, it's good," it will not be enough. You need to keep on telling the story, and the story needs to tell itself just by seeing the artwork. And that's what makes it unique and valuable.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's like there could be two pieces of art. You know, let's say I made a piece of art, people made the same piece of art, and it's exactly the same. My piece of art would sell for $20. Beeple's piece would sell for, you know, 100,000 plus, right? So it's such an interesting thing, and it's so driven by human behavior and like mimesis, or mimetic behavior, or whatever. It's super, super interesting. There's a lot of weird psychology that goes into, you know, the art world, which is pretty exciting.
Exactly. And just to conclude on that, you know, when you study Van Gogh, for instance, Vincent Van Gogh, he's an amazing painter, and what he did is, you know, immediately recognizable. So aesthetically, you can recognize it. But truth is that if he didn't have this story that he almost never sold painting during his whole life, apart from one, and because also his brother died 6 months after him, and that's actually his widow of his brother that eventually told the story to museum, etc., etc., probably that today we don't know Van Gogh. You know, he would have been a guy that is just painting as he did, but without all the story. I'm not sure he would be there where he is today. That's a pity, but that's the way it goes.
All right. So tell me about data aggregation, because I like, you know, like, how are you? This world is so big. It's so weird. It's so because like, how do you quantify a story, right? So like, I think in investing, data is just very important, you know, collecting numbers and information. How are you able to collect data and put semblance to this world that is like so weird and so unusual?
So we split, so that's a very good question. So basically we split the data in two categories. There is the qualitative information, I would call it, and the quantitative information. The qualitative is exactly what we discussed before, which is, okay, assess, you know, the artist's footprint in the market and the storytelling, even say the number of followers or the kind of engagement this person can drive, you know, even in the media, you know, the kind of number of articles or whatever. So that's the qualitative approach, even though you can quantify them, but most of the things eventually need to be assessed with a qualitative approach. And then you've got the quantitative approach, which is more, you know, we have a lot of, you know, ratios or kind of mathematical equation that can give us, say, again, within the for the same artists and for two different collections, we'll run our engines, and the engine will say, well, you know, this collection is undervalued and this collection might be overvalued. And because we don't do long shorts, we'll not buy the overvalued and we'll buy the undervalued. But only, and the quantitative component only comes into force only if the qualitative approach said they are equivalent. And they are equivalent because of the story, they are equivalent because of the aesthetic, who collects it, obviously. But it's always both, you know, we are always looking at both the qualitative and quantitative approach to make the investment choice at the end.
And then when you guys are Like, do you have to also have a big phone book where you're talking to all these collectors and like being like, you know, because you have to talk to the right people that own the right pieces. You have to talk to the actual artists and try to convince them, hey, I want to buy 10-year pieces, whatever. Because in crypto, I feel like there's not a lot of human component to it unless you want, you know, unless you want there to be that, right? If you want to go on, if you want to go trade some crypto tokens, you just go Binance, Coinbase, whatever. Digital art, I feel like, might be very different, where it's maybe very human-centric. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's true. And actually, that's what I like, because that, again, where people bring value, you know? Again, if you... It's not that easy, but say that you just want to collect some collections, only secondary. Oh, I think that probably in 3-4 years, you know, quant traders could be okay in doing that, you know, just because they scrap the market and they come with some kind of algorithm and they kind of can understand. Well, it's okay for the short term. I'm not so sure in the long term, because the long term, again, because you are there to make bets on who will be cultural significance in 10 years and not right now or in 5 years, I think they might miss some stuff, because sometimes the financial information in the market is not the correct one. Sometimes the market is wrong. And I've got a couple of examples, like when you have a couple of drops, say like Pinder van Armen. He did a drop, I think it was Thursday night or Wednesday night, I cannot remember, last week, on Super Rare. This is a great collection. The mint was at 1 ETH. And in 1 minute, it was done. So I didn't get any. And the price, the first price, listing price, was 2.5 or 2.6, which is fine, you know. Right now, it's 1.10, 4 days after. So, you know, I think you have to wait sometimes, because, you know, the market information that you had on the night was that it was 2.6. But the market today is not, it doesn't agree with that. So we have to, in the very short term and even the short term, we have to be extremely, you know, vigilant about what we are looking. And the long term is our goal. And that's why we believe that we will always, you know, value more the qualitative estimate rather than the quantitative information that we've got from the market. But coming back to what you were saying, actually, what you can buy right now, you can buy on primary, you can buy on secondary, you can commission artworks. So that's what we are aiming to do, you know, to buy from the free kind of source. And obviously, it all goes back to, you know, who you know in the market. Do you know the right DAOs, the right collectors, the right even auction house? I don't know if you saw, but Sotheby's last week, I think, did a couple of sales, you know, private sales with another investor that is not us, and they did a bundle sale. And they did, I think there was a Fidenza, there might be some Squiggle in that. And that's fine, you know, there's, and what I like is that it is a market. And that's a good proof. When someone says, oh, it's not a market, I said, yes, come on, look, Sotheby's, Christie's, you know, there's even some brokers, you know, it's a market, it's a small market, but it's starting to be a market. And just because there are some market participants that are working days and nights to make it being a market, I think it will grow. Just because those people are doing a great job.
Very cool. Okay. So quickly touching upon the qualitative aspects, because I think that that's so interesting, you know, how, you know, before making a specific acquisition of a type of art, do you go and reach out to the artists and talk to them and try to understand who they are as people? Like maybe they're like, oh, I just got into this because I saw the art was going on. NFT art was going crazy in 2021. Now I'm like, I'm over it. I assume like that would be a negative quantitative signal. But like, you know, tell me about that process. Like, are you talking to these artists and getting their backstory and getting the vibe of how they feel about NFT art or digital art?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. There is different ways to answer that question. The short answer is yes. We try to meet, or at least we try to discuss with the investors, the creators and therefore the artists. Sorry. And the reason is simple: is because we have a thesis, which is what we call the artist entrepreneurs. Right now, most of the famous and successful digital artists, Beeple, Xcopy, Refik Anadol, you know, Eric Calderon, Snowflow, for Chromy Squiggles, and actually all of them, you know, all the ones that are successful, they are creators, artists, but they are entrepreneurs because they do more than just creating art. They are not only Basquiat, and they are their agent and their communication agent, and their galleries all together. And so basically we assess, you know, not only the aesthetic and cultural significance of their art, and specifically the artwork that we are looking into, but also we believe, if we believe that they will still be there in 5, 10 years, 15 years, are they genuinely artists? So that's one component. And also, do they have this kind of entrepreneurial mindset? So that, and it's fine if they are not, by the way. There are some great artists that are simply artists, and that's perfectly fine. But some of them, they will need to have this entrepreneurial mindset just because that's the way they might succeed in their artwork. And again, that's totally fine. I know a lot of great artists that will still be great artists in 10, 15 years that don't have this business acumen or this way of thinking. And sometimes, you know, there are some artists that goes a little bit too far in that entrepreneurial stuff, which is probably not the right thing to do as well, but that's a different topic. But voilà, so that, this is, yeah, so long, very long answer to say yes, we try to discuss. We try to have at very least, you know, discussion with artists we collect, especially if we want to get a big exposure to their artwork, because we need to be sure that they will still be artists in 5 years. And unfortunately, we saw over the past, you know, say 18 months that some artists quit, creators quit. And that's normal because they have to find a job. So maybe some of them will come back and some of them will just be totally disgusted from, you know, the NFT stuff and they will never come back. So some people might have bought some very nice NFTs from great creators, but that will never be famous because they quit. And apart maybe, you know, just like Vivian Mayer with a famous photographer that has never been famous when she was alive, a New York photographer. Maybe that in 50 years, someone will discover them again. But 50 years is a bit too far for me because I probably will not be there anymore. So I need to have this time horizon that is more the next 20, 30 years.
Very cool. Okay, so I want to zoom out a little bit. I think that, you know, digital art is opening up art as a medium and kind of expanding it. You know, people are like going to be able to experience their art, you know, especially with augmented reality, virtual reality, like, you know, a lot of really, really, really cool things happening. What is art going to evolve into? Like, are we going to, I don't know, go to a museum and like experience an art piece? Are we going to walk through and see like, I don't know, this whole immersive art thing going on? Or what is your opinion?
Well, that's a very good question. I would say, you know, my feeling is that because of the digital aspects, art and culture will be much, much broader and much more global. And therefore, right now, you know, if you say you just look at art and this 2.2 trillion market right now. Honestly, how many people own art? You know, a few hundred of thousands, maybe more. No, probably not more than that. And still, you have millions of people who goes to museums. You know, and a lot of people who goes to museums, they don't own art. Why they don't own art is because it's difficult, it's expensive. You don't really know what you buy. There is no secondary market. You might find a nice painting when you go to the seaside and it happens to be a very nice painting, but you know, it's worth just the cost of the paintbrush and the frame. Maybe it has no cultural value and nobody knows, you know? So I think that because of digital, because of immediate, you know, pricing from the market, because you can trade, you can list and sell eventually. Again, I think that it will bring market to art, to the masses. For me, digital would bring art and culture to the masses. And that's also why I believe that it's great. And that's also why I believe that it will become even bigger than the traditional art market. It has the power to do so.
Amazing. Okay. All right, sir, this has been absolutely amazing, but we are coming close on time here. Time for the closing questions. Alrighty. What are you bullish on? And you can't say digital art, obviously.
Just because I was there before, just before this podcast, I was at the Korean Cultural Center in Paris. I am extremely bullish on South Korea.
Very cool. Wait, tell me more.
I think for me, it's a fascinating country. It was almost a third world country 30 years ago, something like that. And right now, it's one of the most advanced country in terms of education, research, and conglomerates with Samsung and so many companies. And actually, again, I was at the cultural center, and you know, that says something. Though this country, that is again one of the most wealthy country per inhabitants in terms of GDP, they are in Paris and have this amazing building with a great collection of digital art. You know what? That's what I was there because there was Mr. Misang, who's one of the most famous, you know, Korean digital artist who is doing an exhibition there right now. For me, that says a lot. You know, for me, culture is also a very important component of a soft power of a country. When you look at history of art, again, you know, the US, when they started becoming a huge country from an economic standpoint, culture was one thing. And it started to become, you know, the capital of art became New York. Before it was London or Paris. So for me, the fact that they invest so much in culture says a lot about this country. And so that's probably for me, I'm bullish on South Korea. Yes.
Oh, that's very cool. Awesome. All right. What are you bearish on?
I'm bearish on probably museum who are a bit stuck in the past. And I'm not asking for all the museum to embrace, you know, digital like that. But I still think that there is a middle ground and there is just an exploratory phase for them. And I think that what the MoMA did, for instance, with Refik Anadol is for me the blueprint for others, because they tested it. Maybe they were not totally confident, and then eventually it worked. And so they kept it, and then they acquired it or they got donated it. So for me, I would be bearish on museums that are a bit stuck in the past and that don't want to hear at all about digital art and, oh, these things, they don't exist because I cannot touch it. I think I'm bearish on them because I think they will have difficult times of it.
What is their main point of pushback? Are they like this is a fad? You know, what is the risk to them? Because they're just a place that people go and see art. Like, who cares if it's digital or physical? Are they nervous that their reputation could be damaged, or why are they scared?
Honestly, I'm not in their mind. I don't want to be in their mind. You know, so I the kind of pushback. It's very traditional pushbacks and all the stuff that you heard many times as well. But I think it's more like, again, I think it's a very human thing to say, it's new, it's a bit technical, totally. I don't understand it, oh, I don't want to hear it. Because it's more convenient when something is kind of alien to you, it's different from you. You know, most of the people are just pushing back because they don't want to understand it. So that's the most easy route for most of the people.
All right, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Be curious.
I like that. All right, last question. What motivates you?
I'm motivated by what my daughter can think of me in 20 years from now.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I love that. That's so good. Wow. Well, sir, this was incredible. Thank you so much for joining me. I learned so much. You're coming back on in 20 years. You agree, in 20 years. Hopefully before as well, but 20 years for sure. We're locked in.
Yeah.
People want to find out more about yourself, find out more about Grail Capital, where should they go? What should they do?
Sorry. So they need to go, either they follow me on Twitter. So I am at JMPAILHON, or simply Grail, GRAILCAP.XYZ. And, you know, you can follow us. We try to communicate on Twitter mostly, but happy to meet you at some point during conference as well. See you soon.
Amazing. Thank you.